I'm going to tell you, as Kevin said, about the classification for of topological phases. Also, I find slides can be hard to watch, so I've put the slides online in case you want to see them at a different, go back or forward or something. The plan for my talk, I'm going to start with sort of some preliminary comments about phases of matter, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about gapped condensation. And these two sections are based on work with Davide Gaiotto. And I'll be pretty brief on especially in the gap condensation section, because I gave a lecture on it a few months ago at Perimeter that you can find up on Pearsa. Then for the second half of the talk, I'm going to tell you about the new work on topological orders and really what we can, I think we can really sort of give a pretty exact classification of what I'll call algebraic topological orders. And I'll end with some mathematical conjectures that are kind of leading towards what I think of as a higher spin statistics theorem. Also, I should say, I would love to be interrupted with questions, because shouting at the internet is kind of hard to do. So when we talk about phases of matter, I'm going to remind, like, basically a cartoon picture that we learned all as children. But my talk's not about phases of water, so it doesn't matter that the cartoon picture is inaccurate. In the cartoon picture, you imagine taking the space of systems of water, and at least at the sort of kindergarten level, a system of water is determined by two parameters, a temperature and a pressure. And so then you can take the space of all systems, and it naturally breaks up into three components. And those three components are the three different phases of water. And there's some subtle question about how to decide how to break up the components. But the rough idea is that what we want to do is have a topology on the space of systems of water, so that continuous paths are not allowed to cross the phase transitions. We want to encode this qualitative behavior that we see in nature in a mathematical framework. And when people over the 20th century studied in detail what was going on at those phase transitions, one of the things that happens at phase transitions is that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian undergoes a topological change, namely gaps between eigenvalues open and close. The question of asking what are the components of a space is a very coarse version of asking about the homotopy of the space. It's the sort of zeroth level of asking about the homotopy of the space. Another more sophisticated example, another more, oh, so, okay, sorry, I had my slides in a different order when I was practicing. I'm gonna focus on the case of gap topological systems. A system of matter is gap topological when, in addition to having a gap between the bottom of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, I also wanna ask that the ground states, the very low energy behavior of the system, feels like a topological field theory. I want to warn that this is not yet a mathematically precise notion. Of course, we know what it means for a Hamiltonian to have a gap in the spectrum, but making sense of the word gapped in a fully local way, I don't think has been done, at least not in a satisfactory way. So as with everything in this world, there's a lot of physical assumptions about what the behavior should be. That said, the goal that a lot of people have is to, a particular goal within condensed matter research is to classify gapped topological phases of matter. And a sub-goal of that is to classify invertible gapped phases of matter. So a phase is invertible if there's some other phase that you can stack on top of it, so that the combination isn't the trivial phase. Another important example, a much more modern example of this phenomenon, are topological insulators. I'm not a material scientist, but roughly speaking, a topological insulator is a system that has some useful insulating behavior. And the reason it has that insulating behavior is because it's in a non-trivial topological phase. See, you want to use this material, and so it's going to get bombarded with electrons or whatever it's insulating against. And that bombardment could a priori change its behavior. So the thing that prevents it from changing is some topology. Now, if you look closely at it, it turns out that the topological insulator is in the trivial connected component of the system of gap topological, of the space of gap topological systems. So it's not in a non-trivial phase of matter in the sense that I set it up, but it is non-trivial as a G-symmetric phase, where the group G is U1 times time reversal. So the U1 is rotating some electric charge. So it's an example of what's called a G-symmetry protected phase, or GSPT. And it's that extra G-symmetry that makes it a non-trivial phase and that protects it from being, from decaying to the trivial phase when you try to use it in practice. In mathematics, the way we'd set that up is to say that for any group G, for instance, for the group U1 times that time reversal, there's a classifying space. You can build a topological space called its classifying space, which is called BG. And the collection of all phases of G-symmetric systems can be identified with, so this, that set can be identified with the components of the space of maps from the topological space BG to the topological space of systems. And this space, this pi zero of maps, is probing higher homotopy in the space of systems. So overall, what we want to do is not just classify into like the components of the space, but we want to classify the whole homotopy of the space of systems. As I said, there's not good definitions in this subject right now. So I'm going to make a physical assumption that's going to hold throughout the talk, which is that that when we do have a good definition of what it means to be a gap topological system, the assumption I want to make is that if you make a modification over here on one part of the in one part of spacetime, so and if you make that modification in a gapped way, your choice of how to do that modification, say of like an operator insertion or something, that choice doesn't affect the choices of gap modification in some other region. Now, of course, it might affect the actual physics because they might kind of, as time propagates, they might interact. But this is a sort of locality statement that if you in your lab do something, it shouldn't change the possible experiments I can do in my lab. If you have this assumption, then you can actually compile all of these sort of all the gap topological systems of some dimension into a higher category. Higher categories are a very rich area in mathematics. There's a lot known about it. I should also flag that by now we're at the point of being able to write down exact definitions of higher categories. But the subject of higher category theory is somewhat famous for being an area of math where all the theorems were proved before the definitions were written down. And then the theorems are sort of guiding the development of the definitions. And some of the things I say later in the talk, I think, should fit into that frame. In any case, the particular category I have in mind, you take the objects of this category. So a category is something that has some collection of objects, and then between any pair of objects, there's some morphisms. So the collection of objects I'm gonna take are all the, say, translation invariant and plus one dimensional gap topological systems. The morphisms between any pair of objects are all of the gapped interfaces that you could put between those two systems. So by gapped interface, an interface itself might have its own excitations. And I mean that those excitations are also gap topological. Yes, Lee.
If a system is topological, what do you mean by a translation? Because there's translations. Translations leave the states unchanged.
Great. So I just mean let me say by counterexample, an example of a system that's somehow topological but not translation invariant is a system with an interface inserted.
A boundary.
Yeah, for instance, because then as you move that interface, you've changed the location of the interface.
Good. But if you had a topological theory on the compact manifold, there'd be no notion of translation.
So there's subtle things when I talk about gapped phases. So what I really want is that the phase is translation invariant. Microscopically, it won't be translation invariant. Microscopically, the model in most examples is a lattice. And so as you translate the phase, it will actually change the details of the microscopic system. But I want the phase to stay the same. One of the side effects of that is, say, if you're on a torus, you could translate all the way around the torus. And you might come back to the same phase, but you might have picked up some monodromy as you go around. Sure. And so there are subtle notions in the notion of translation invariance when you have kind of when you're not on flat space. But I'm gonna, for my talk, most of this is about sort of things going on just Rn and not on a compact manifold. Okay, you've turned your camera off, so I'll assume that you were satisfied with my answer. Anyway, so, you're back. No, you're gone.
I hope you don't mind because there's
that's great.
People use these
questions. I want these questions, please.
I don't understand what you mean by a topological theory on Rn. Rn has a metric. And
yes.
A theory on Rn has correlation functions that know about that metric.
It doesn't have to.
Well, good. So why are you...
I agree with you that most theories on Rn are not topological.
Right, but why do you even mention Rn? Just say a four-dimensional manifold up to diffeomorphisms.
Because it's not obvious that a gapped phase in the way that people set them up in condensed matter labs can be put on an arbitrary manifold.
Good. So this is the definition issues that are messing us up sometimes. So it's very
right.
Good.
As I said, there's to my knowledge not a satisfactory definition of gapped phase because exactly of the sort of I would like to work locally on a patch of Rn and talk, but there's a kind of conflict right now between wanting to work locally and still wanting to say words like gapped. So in any case, what I was saying was that if you have kind of, you can ignore the word translation invariant. You can take the objects to the n plus one dimensional gapped phases. And then a morphism between any pair of objects is an interface that can separate those two phases. In a category, morphisms need to have a way of composing. In this category, the way that you compose two things is you put one interface over here, you put another interface over here, separated at some distance scale that's much larger than the microscopic scale of your phases, and then you zoom out. And as you zoom out, what you see is those interfaces coming closer and closer together. Now, if you were not in a topological phase, then that zooming out would be really changing the behavior away from the interface. And so it wouldn't be a very good thing to do. But because I'm in a topological phase, the low energy behavior away from the interfaces is unchanged. And so the end result of that zooming out procedure is I have an interface that's a single interface separating the same two phases. Similarly, two morphisms are junctions between interfaces, three morphisms are junctions between junctions, and so on. So I want to mention a technical theorem that we didn't actually write it this way in the paper, but this is an n plus one category that you can canonically define from physics, at least once you've given a definition of gapped topological phase. And our theorem is that this n plus one category satisfies a technical condition called being Siegel complete. I'm not going to tell you what Siegel complete is. It's some technical condition in category literature. Most of the time, category theorists tend to just take something that's not Siegel complete and force it to be. There's a sort of completion procedure, but that forcing it to be complete could lose physical information. In this case, we don't have to. It's already Siegel complete. A side effect of that is that if you take the space of all n plus one dimensional invertible phases, I'll call that curly I n plus one, that those spaces, as n goes to infinity, those spaces compile into a structure called an omega spectrum. I also won't give you the definition of omega spectra, but I want to mention a few things about them. First of all, they're the basic objects of stable homotopy theory. They're the abelian groups of stable homotopy theory. They are the same as generalized cohomology theories. And they're really useful because spaces, a priori, I have spaces of phases. Spaces are really flimsy in topology, and it's really hard to compute with them. We don't have very many techniques for computing, say, this set of connected components of a mapping space between spaces. We have a lot of techniques for computing with spectra. And those techniques have been developed in the algebraic topology literature now for at least 70 years. For example, I mentioned before that we might be interested specifically in the G-symmetry protected phases. And one of the side effects of this theorem is that G-symmetry protected phases are classified by the reduced group cohomology with values in this generalized cohomology theory represented by curly I. And this is something you can really like try to calculate as a mathematician. Even better than that, the spectrum curly I satisfies a condition called co-connectivity, which is some statement about homotopy groups. And what co-connectivity implies to a physicist, like the reason it's useful for physics, is it tells you that any finite piece of the spectrum, say you only want to classify invertible phases up to some dimension, it tells you that that problem of classifying phases up to dimension n plus one is determined by finitely many, I'll call them experiments. There's finitely many groups, G, and if you can work out what the set of all GSPTs is up to that dimension for those groups, then you've worked out the spectrum. But there's infinitely many total groups, so that really makes some predictions. There's still a question of predicting and working out this spectrum. As I said, you can, if you know this classification up to some dimension for enough groups, then you can work out the spectrum. And so we can confirm a conjecture that Kapustin made maybe a decade ago, predicting what these spectra are. He said that for bosonic phases, he predicted that the spectrum was something called the shifted Anderson dual of MSO. And for fermionic phases, he got M spin. It doesn't matter what the right-hand sides are, you should know that they're really well-studied, really rich, really complicated objects from algebraic topology. We do know a lot about them. We don't know their complete values or anything like that, but we know a lot about them. And I want to mention that this conjecture of Kapustin's is actually really surprising. So a priori in a condensed matter lab, you imagine that you've written down a microscopic description of a phase of matter that might have some microscopic description that's completely rotationally, that has no rotation invariance at all. Maybe it has some lattice, and maybe the lattice directions are all different. And so microscopically, there's no rotation symmetry. As Lee will probably point out, if I'm in a topological phase, in the topological phase, you get some emergent symmetry under continuous rotations. But that symmetry is a sort of subtle thing, as we were just discussing, where if I do a full 360 degree rotation, as you probably know from thinking about fermions, you might pick up some non-trivial sort of automorphisms by taking your phase and rotating it all the way around continuously. What Kapustin's conjecture tells you is that actually you don't, or the only ones you do are that fermionic thing. You don't get anything else that could be weird. So it tells you in some sense that for every gap topological, well, at least for every invertible phase, you get you get something invariant under rotations in Wick rotated space. And at the end of the talk, I'll try to say why, sort of an explanation or generalization of this. So anyway, I'm going to switch gears for a moment. So if you zoned out, you can wake back up. I'm going to tell you a little bit about gapped condensation, just because it's kind of underlying the second half of what I want to say. But as I said, you can on Pearce. So I have a whole lecture that I gave in March that has many more details. Sorry, I could not hear what somebody just said. I'm not even sure who said it. So now I want to imagine the following situation. I have some phase, some gap topological phase X, and I have some condensation procedure, some physical procedure that condenses it to some other gap topological phase Y. What is condensation? I don't know. It's something like you change the temperature and some water precipitates out on a piece of glass. Or you add some salt to a material or something. So when you do this, you could imagine adiabatically transitioning, adiabatically in space, changing from phase X to phase Y. So you like have it warm over here and cold over there. So, and that would be some continuous transformation that you see in your laboratory. And now I'll do the same thing. I will zoom very far away, and that continuous transformation looks now like an interface between the two systems. And this really uses the fact that the outside, that's the bulk systems, are gap topological in order to do this zooming out. Now, any interface might carry some excitations, and there's no reason why this one wouldn't. I'll call the condensation procedure gap topological if the interface is also gap topological. And I'm not saying that the condensation procedure itself doesn't open or close any gaps. It's like being a gap topological procedure is like that it opens and closes finitely many gaps. When this happens, you can build a junction from X to itself by kind of going from X, by condensing out a sort of slab in the middle. You have sort of phase system X on the outside and condense a slab of, in the middle, condense a slab to Y. And again, zoom out. And the statement is that that slab of Y has an algebra structure, because another thing I could do is condense a Y shape in space or space-time. Going the other way, you can take a system in phase X and fill it with a network of Y slabs. And by doing that, there's a way to use the algebra structure to recover the phase Y. And with Davide, we studied this behavior and came up with a notion that we called condensation algebra in any dimension. It matches what's called condensation algebra in low dimensions, what the sort of literature already called condensation algebra, and a kind of categorical condensation. And what we discovered was that categorical condensation, the condensation algebras are the higher category version of functions that square to themselves, of idempotents. And categorical condensation is the higher categorical version of taking the image of a function that squares to itself. And the space of all gap topological phases satisfies another technical condition in category theory called Kurubi completeness. We could also show that there were three, sorry, Lita, do you have another question?
Yes, could you go back to the previous one? What's the difference between the right-handed and the left-handed picture? What do you?
The only difference is I zoomed out.
Okay. And so this is the condensation of a network of one phase and another phase.
So the picture was a picture of this picture that I drew is a picture of just sort of creating the junction from this slab of Y to two copies of the slab of Y to itself.
Yes.
To go back, if I know this, if I know this algebra structure, if I know the value of, if I know what this blue interface is as an interface from X to itself, and I know this algebra structure, then I can fill X with a kind of network that, see if I can draw it, that kind of in 2D would look like a kind of hexagon network.
Right.
And I don't know, you fill X with a network and the algebra, I didn't tell you what a condensation algebra is, what the axioms are, but the axioms tell you that then once you fill that with a network, there's a way to recover Y from that network of interfaces.
And are the blue areas acting something like, when you zoom out, acting like something like defects?
Yes. So on the left-hand side, what you see is kind of the phase X and then an interface to phase Y in some complicated behavior and then an interface back to phase X. When you zoom out, what you just see is phase X and then an interface back to phase X. But that interface is still non-trivial.
Right, and that's a defect.
It's a special type of defect. That's right. And if I then later go and fill X with a network of these defects and zoom out again, what I actually see the phase Y.
Right. Beautiful.
So this would.
And just to guess, if you now turn on a Hamiltonian, can you evolve that network with local moves?
Yes. The axioms for condensation algebra allow this network to be modified in local ways.
Beautiful. Thank you.
My pleasure. That was, well, whatever. So using this machinery, we could show that three a priori very different categories were the same. We could show that if you take basically the category of vector spaces, treated as an n plus one category, and Kurubi complete it, we could show that was the same as the category of, well, not the category of all gap topological phases, but the category of gap topological phases that arise from the vacuum via gap topological condensation. And we could also show that this was equivalent to the category, the n category of all n-dimensional field theories. And we can realize them as in commuting Hamiltonian projector type. And I just want to flag that as I said before, anytime I'm talking about gap topological phases, I'm conditional on a sort of physical assumption that we will eventually have a definition of gap topological phase that has this local structure. The equivalence in the theorem between statements 1 and 3 is a purely mathematical statement. It has a purely mathematical proof. That proof depends on some basic facts about that are technical facts in higher category theory that haven't yet been carefully written down in the higher category literature, but I'm sure that they will be straightforward. But as I said, this is an area of math where often theorems are written before definitions are written. But in the proof, we say exactly what axioms we're going to need about an eventual theory. Okay, so as I said, the reason I was talking about that was to use some notions about, so that later I can say the word Karubi completion and so on. And so now I want to switch gears to some new work that I did in March. So I want to talk about topological orders. Xiaogang Wen uses the word topological order, roughly speaking, for gap topological phases up to stacking with invertible phases. And I think the language hasn't settled in the literature, so other people might use the word topological order for something slightly differently. I want to warn that this stacking, normally we think of sort of quotienting as a sort of subtraction where you identify things. In this case, the quotient both adds and subtracts equivalence classes because before taking the quotient, there might have been two different invertible phases and an interface between them, which was not itself a well-defined system because it was really a boundary for an invertible phase. After doing the quotient, the two invertible phases are now identified, are now both thought of as trivial. And so that boundary condition should now be thought of as itself an honest system, or an honest topological order. The reason why you might want to do this quotient is because if you might try to axiomatize physics just in terms of the algebras of operators. So that's the most physical part of studying a physical system are the vertex operators, but also the extended operators. And if you take a system and stack it with an invertible phase, you actually do not change the algebra of operators, including the extended operators. And so if you care about only algebras of operators, you don't see actual topological phases. All you can see are the corresponding topological orders. That's basically the difference between kind of a Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture of topological phases. So based on that, I worked out a definition of a mathematical definition to match this idea of Xiaogang's. So to tell it to you, I need to mention that there's what I worked out first was a definition of fusion N category. The notion of fusion category is really well understood and kind of bread and butter for practicing condensed matter theorists. The definition of a fusion N category is a monoidal N category, which is at least twice dualizable. And that means that these the configurations that I've drawn on the right can be first that you can arrange them at all, and then that you can continuously unkink them. And I proved some theorems about dualizability of these and sort of clarifying what this condition was that match kind of that are categorifications of sort of well understood things in ordinary algebra. And given that definition of fusion category, I could say that an algebraic topological order, as opposed to Xiaogang's sort of physical topological orders, I'll define an algebraic topological order to be exactly this algebra of operators, the fusion N category. So that I'm thinking of the objects in that category as n-dimensional interfaces between from the phase to itself, n-dimensional operators. The morphisms are junctions between those and so on. And I want to ask that it not be arbitrary, but rather it satisfy a condition called remote detectability. The physics of remote detectability is that is the following. You have some phase, you might do an operator insertion. Now, how could you detect that you did that operator insertion? If that operator's insertion is going to be a meaningful thing, you'd better be able to detect that you did it. The only way in fusion N categories to detect that you did a topological insertion was by linking it with some other operator. by detecting it as with some other operator. And the mathematical name for the other operator that would detect it has to do with what's, so it's basically like a type of commutator. And so saying that there's nothing that's, so that the things that would be undetectable are the center of the algebra. And so I'm asking that this algebra have trivial center. And then what I could prove is that I couldn't quite prove the statement about topological phases because those don't have a mathematical definition yet. But I could prove that algebraic topological orders are this, the ratio, are the quotient of topological field theories in the mathematical sense, modulo invertible field theories. And it's very close to being true for topological phases as well, except that we don't have definitions. So now I want to tell you what we can do with this definition, which is that we really can do an exact mathematical classification of these. So I'll go through sort of more and more dimensions. So in 0 plus 1D, at least bosonically over C, all topological orders are sums of invertibles. In 1 plus 1D, that's also true if you're working bosonically over C without time reversal. In 2 plus 1D, the story is well known to be extremely rich. You get modular tensor categories and actually sort of sums of modular tensor categories. One of the main reasons I started thinking about this was actually a very inspiring series of papers by Lan Kong and Wen, and then by Lan and Wen, who announced a classification of 3 plus 1D topological orders. And they were very honest in the paper that they didn't claim to have a mathematical framework for making their theorem, their announcement completely correct, but they outlined a really interesting argument for their classification. What they announced was that up to some subtleties having to do with emergent fermions, all 3 plus 1 dimensional topological phases are actually canonically topological sigma models with target finite group weights. And then because they're topological sigma models, you can really like write down formulas, you can write down exact descriptions of these phases. So their argument had two steps. The first step of their argument, they said, given a 3 plus 1 dimensional topological phase, well, the line operators in 3D, there's enough room for them to just, there's no interesting braiding of line operators in 3 plus 1D. And so they said that we could take all of the line operators and condense them all out at the same time. And then the result of that condensation would be some, so and then the group weight that they care about ends up being the kind of group weight of all ways to do that. And the result after that condensation, they said, was a phase without any line operators. And they argued that that must be an invertible phase. And then the sigma model Lagrangian ends up compiling all of those invertible phases. Yes.
What about surface operators?
That's a great question. So I'm about to get to that.
Thank you.
And as I said, like their argument, I'm telling you their argument, but it needed some filling. So I think this is the point about surface operators. So I'm going to tell you about these in sort of in the other order. I'm going to talk about this invertibility issue and then about the condensation issue. So Lan Kong and Wen argued the following. They said, suppose we're in n plus one dimensions for any n. Then they said if there are no line operators, then they said there must also be no n minus one dimensional operators. And so in 3D, that in 3 plus 1D, that would mean no surface operators. Their reason for this, their argument was that they said the only way to detect an n minus one dimensional operator was by linking it with the line operator. And that argument's not very good. In particular, it's actually just false. So you can always build an m-dimensional operator as a network of operators that are one-dimensional. So they're always, if you're say in seven dimensions and you have no line operators, you still have six-dimensional operators that are networks of five-dimensional operators. But I'll consider those networks to be trivial because they can be constructed in a systematic way from the lower-dimensional operators. So with that addendum, then it's a non-trivial theorem. I had to work a little while, but I was able to prove the kind of corrected version of the statement. So the other part of the argument involved condensing all the line operators. And you could ask, like, why is that even a thing you could do? And the answer is actually really interesting. So I wanna, before I tell you why you can do that, I wanna talk about, go back to the one plus one dimensional situation. So in 1+1 dimensions, I just sort of casually said they're all sums of invertible things. Mm-hmm. This is something that people know. But when you press why it's true, the reason it's true is because if you have a vacuum degeneracy, a local ground state degeneracy in a topological phase, the phase itself is is unstable. You can add a small operator that will distinguish the different ground states and will condense you onto a single ground state. And so if you're in 1+1 dimensions, that sort of gives you a set of all ground states as the set of choices for how to do this. And the final phase is a sum over that set of invertible phases. And I want to mention that this fails in the presence of a Z2 time reversing symmetry, because that symmetry might be permuting ground states. Mathematically, the difference between the two situations is that if you don't have a time reversal symmetry, the algebra of vertex operators is naturally a complex commutative algebra, an algebra over the complex numbers. And the time reversal symmetry gives it a form over the real numbers. In order to condense to a ground state, in order to find that ground state, you have to solve a polynomial equation. And everybody knows that you can always solve polynomial equations over the complex numbers, but not over the real numbers. So going back to the 3+1D case that I care about, that's actually the argument that happens. This isn't the way that it's been said in the literature before I did, but back in the 90s, I guess, Deligne proved a theorem that's equivalent to the following state. What Deligne's theorem was that there's a way of, if you look at it with the right glasses on, what you discover is that there's a meaningful way to talk about polynomial equations where instead of numbers, the coefficients and variables are objects in a category. And Deligne's theorem is the same as saying that over supervector spaces, every one categorical polynomial equation has a solution. And so using that, what you find is that for any fermionic 3+1 dimensional topological order, you can always do the same thing. You can condense it to a single vacuum because you can solve this equation. And so that then, as I said, the group weight in the Lan Kong Wen theorem ends up being the group weight of all ways to do that. And just like the case of the reals over the complexes had some relation to time reversal, if you really wanted to work bosonically, there's some sort of fermion parity flipping one-form symmetry that gets in the way, and you end up picking up an anomaly that has to do with the emergent fermions. And so you can't, the theorem, as I said, wasn't quite true bosonically, but also they didn't claim it bosonically. They claimed it if there's no emergent fermions, which is when there's sort of no anomaly for this one-form symmetry. So in any case, to summarize, the theorem that I can now completely prove is that in 3+1D, every fermionic 3+1 dimensional topological order arises canonically as a certain type of topological sigma model. And if you want to work bosonically, you have to work equivariantly for time reversal one-form symmetry. Going higher in 4+1D, so I think the classification is really within reach. I think we sort of have a pretty good idea of what it is. Matthew Yu, who's in the audience, has been helping me with some of the calculations, has been learning a lot of cohomology of finite groups, and will help with some of the computations. In odd plus one dimensions, you get this, you should expect this phenomenon about for sigma models, and in even plus one dimensions, it's a little bit more complicated. In 5+1D, I can prove they're all sigma models, at least fermionically. And this is because in a sort of pre-theorem, I have a detailed outline of the proof. I can prove that actually every, even at the level of two categories, every two categorical polynomial equation has solutions over super two categories. I think 6+1D looks quite feasible. In 7+1D, you would need to be able to solve polynomial equations over three categories. And I know for a fact that the three category of super two categories does not contain solutions to all polynomial equations. And just like kind of to go from vector spaces to super vector spaces where you could solve things, you had to add some fermions. We would need to add something new to get to three categories, to get to 7+1D, if you wanted them to all be sigma models. And I'm gonna call them string-ons, but I don't have a proposed definite, like I don't have the details worked out at that level. I don't know what three categories should have solutions to all polynomial equations. Yes.
When you get to 7 and 8, do you see any way to make an exceptional category?
Maybe I don't think I quite understand the question.
I don't think I quite understand it either, but it's tempting to wonder if an extra structure opens up there.
So let me say a little bit about these. What you need, one of the things if you have a three category in which it can solve all polynomial equations.
Right.
So what's going on is that somehow a fermion is something like a square root of minus one.
Right.
I mean, it's not. It's a square root of sort of a shifted copy of minus one. And there's a sense in which so by the time you get to three categories, what you need is a sort of to also by hand add in some shifted thing, which ends up being like a 24th root of unity.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be intimately related to the kind of the corresponding third root of shifted unity should be related to basically the E8 invertible phase, or the mm-hmm. E8 holomorphic field theory. So there's some exceptional behavior coming in from that.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
But I'm not saying that that's all you have to do. There might be other things you have to add in by hand. I know you'd have to add that much. Okay. So I'm going to end. I sort of am near the end of my time. Kevin or Ben, how much longer can I talk? They haven't answered, so I'm going to keep going. I won't spend too long, but I want to give a sense of where this is going. So I want to return to this conjecture that I mentioned near the beginning of the talk of Kapustin's about the classification, about predicting the space of all invertible gapped phases. And at least up to sort of this, the difference, there's a sort of subtlety about the difference between working purely algebraically and working where you can have continuous, sort of real, continuous in the sense of the real numbers, continuous transformations. But if you're willing to work algebraically, then the sets of invertible phases end up being the invertible objects in sequences of categories, as I already said. And these sequences compile in a natural way. I call the compilation a tower. So a tower is a sequence of categories where that the category number goes up, and every category in the sequence should be Karubi complete and should contain all the previous entries as morphism categories. And towers are basically an infinitely categorical version of commutative algebra. They're exactly the right framework for asking questions about solving polynomial equations. And the three cases of most interest are either the tower of the real numbers, where you take reals, real vector spaces, real categories, real two categories, real three categories, and so on. The tower of complex numbers and the tower of sort of super complex numbers, where you take, so notice that the beginning of the sequence doesn't necessarily determine the rest. So the bosonic and fermionic entries on my slide, they have the same they have the same first entry, but the second entries are different. Maybe you can't see that, but what is true is that as if the seventh entry determines the zero through the first through sixth entries. So I'm going to make an outlandish conjecture, which is that every tower has what you'd call an algebraic closure in mathematics, that it would be another tower in which you can solve all polynomial equations. The nth entry in the algebraic closure would be the n category in which all polynomial equations whose coefficients are in the nth entry of the original sequence have solutions. And then just because C was the zero categorical algebraic closure of the real numbers, and because supervector spaces were sort of a one categorical algebraic closure, it follows that if the real numbers has an algebraic closure, it's the same as the algebraic closure in the sort of tower sense of the complexes of the supervector spaces. And what I can, well, at least what I have a detailed outline of a proof for, is that at least if this thing exists, then I know exactly what its invertible elements are. It's another object from stable homotopy theory called the Pondragon dual to framed cobordism. Doesn't matter what that is, it's a thing that people understand reasonably well. There's still some questions about it, but it's like a pretty solid, robust object. this world of higher categorical and commutative algebra is also a world in which it makes sense to do a lot of stuff that mathematicians kind of learn in graduate school, basically, called Galois theory. There's a way of saying whether an extension of towers, so a tower living inside of another tower, is a Galois extension, which is it's called Galois if the smaller guy is basically the G fixed points and the larger guy for some Galois group G. And the two examples that we've already talked about are that the reals inside of the complexes is Galois with Galois group time reversal symmetry. And the complexes inside of supervector spaces is Galois with Galois group, the fermion parity flip as a one-form symmetry. And I don't have a reason to believe this particularly, but I conjecture that the reals, that there's this sort of universal object, this algebraic closure of the real tower, and I conjecture that it is Galois. And if so, that this sort of the definition would just tell you, it would let you classify the invertible elements, for instance, in these towers. And the homotopy theorists would call it the Anderson or the Pontryagin dual to G cobordism. The letter M always means cobordism. I'm not sure why it's called M. It was invented by Tom, which doesn't start with an M, and it stands for cobordism, which doesn't start for an M, but that's what it's called. And then this is my last slide. So if you want to make even more progress, you should predict what the Galois group of this extension is. And my expectation, my hope, is that it's actually the orthogonal group. I call this a higher spin statistics theorem because it would actually imply the topological phase version of spin statistics. It would be a kind of higher categorical identification. So in spin statistics, what happens is that in a unitary theory, the time reversal symmetry has to match with complex conjugation. And the spin statistics theorem tells you that in a unitary theory, the rotating by 360 degrees has to match with the fermion parity one-form symmetry. And this would be an infinite sequence of higher categorical statements of that form. And it would only be true sort of in a real analytic topology. I'm sure it's false if you're working too algebraically. And this is something I'm still working on. I don't have a definition of the real analytic topology on these things, proving it would involve really thinking carefully about positivity. And I just want to say at the end that this would be a generalization and expansion, because it immediately proves these Kapustin conjectures that, so analytically, the sort of IC cross is the same as sigma IC. And it would prove this statement about the spectrums of these phases. So thank you. That's what I wanted to tell you. Okay, the internet is silent. Are there questions?
I have a question.
I think Sasha and Marco are both trying to talk.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, so the question is that if you look at the theory of modular tensor categories, in the recent years, there was a lot of interesting progress about the structure of those and positive characteristics. So I wonder whether somehow what you are doing somehow has some interesting positive characteristic version.
So I should say I am very aware of some of that work. By the way, before I even answer the question, let me say, I used the word modular tensor category before. I really mean, for the technicians, I mean non-degenerate braid diffusion category. The ribbon structure in modular tensor categories comes from the sort of spin statistics type stuff, but it's not a priori part of the story.
But for example, you quoted this theorem of Deligne, which essentially says that if you have a symmetric tensor category,
that's right,
then it has a finite function of the supervector spaces. So that fails in terms of characteristic, but
it absolutely
there are some conjectures what is actually true.
That's right. So and that was one of the things I was thinking about when I was doing this work, and continue to think about. So I should also say that for the mathematicians that I lied throughout the talk, I really mean separable extension and not algebraic extension. That I really want to work with separable extensions. And that's because in fusion categories and characteristic zero are automatically separable, but the definition that I want for fusion category and like for topological order has a sort of dualizability, and so I would need to add separability by hand. For separable extensions, it's still true, in even in positive characteristic, that supervector spaces receives all fiber functors. And that was one of the things that follows from the theorem of Victor Ostrich. Ostrich proved a stronger statement that actually he gave a fusion category that was an inseparable extension that receives all fiber functors from all symmetric fusion categories. And if you look at the sort of separable sub-extension, you just get supervector spaces. But no, as soon as you get, so Sasha's question, as soon as you start thinking about positive characteristic, you start having but what I expect you'll see is a sort of complicated gradation of different types of algebraic closure, where you might have sort of a separable closure, and you might have other things that deserve the name algebraic closure that are different. And the difference is sort of how separable closures you only get to test against very, very finite things. And the more inseparable the extension, the less finite the polynomials that you want to solve are.
Okay.
Finite in the sense of dualizability conditions.
So in other words, you're saying that somehow you don't know how to make a positive statement in positive characteristic.
I'm saying that I don't know for what, there's something that would deserve the name algebraic closure, which I don't know how to state in positive characteristic. For if you're willing to go through my slides and change the word algebraic to separable everywhere, then I think there's not much difference. And that's really what I want, because I really want to talk really about like Galois extensions, and inseparable extensions aren't Galois.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
I know that Marco had a question as well.
While we're waiting for Marco, could I ask, I was curious about your higher spin statistics statement, but I didn't, I had trouble, it was too abstract, I didn't follow it. Okay. Is there a way to, I mean, it's not my field, of course.
Well, and also really fast, and it was the mathematics I haven't done yet.
Is there a way, would it correspond to a physical prediction about physically predicted relationship between something and something else in 3+1 dimensional space-time, or can I not think of it like that? Or is there some more intuitive way to maybe a more physical way to describe what it relates?
As I said, one of my goals for the conjecture is to be able to give a proof of this expected classification of invertible phases. Now, I think in dimensions up to 3 or 4, we can just prove that pretty directly anyway. I should say, rather than giving predictions, let me say it's giving an invitation. As we were talking with Lee, I mentioned that kind of by the time you get to 3 categories, you need to add something that I think should be called a string on, because it would have dimension, the object itself, the physical object, would be of 2+1 dimensions. And it would need to solve some sort of, basically be something like a cube root of unity, or it's, in fact, you need to be able to add a 24th root of unity. And the physics of that object is it ends up looking very much like it ends up being closely related to sort of the invertible E8 phase in 2+1D, or maybe to the E8 holomorphic field theory in 1+1D. And especially when this is the first example of a phase which doesn't have a boundary condition, doesn't have a gap boundary condition. So I'm sorry, it has a boundary condition. The 3D phase of the E8 phase in 3D has a gapped boundary called the E8 holomorphic field theory. But that gap, so it has a non-gapped, a gapless boundary. And it's necessarily gapless. And it's the first example of a necessarily gapless boundary condition. What this sort of this algebraic closure would involve a setting in which, even though that boundary condition was gapless, nevertheless it sort of behaves as if it were gapped. I don't know if that
okay, that thanks. Thank you. Yes. It certainly helps. Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
So I have a little question.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit more about how you define a categorical polynomial equation? Like what it means to solve polynomials over some category.
Yeah, so I was using that language so that sort of intentionally sort of slightly wrong. So the specific definition I have in mind is, as Sasha already noticed because he knew what theorem of Deligne's I was talking about. What I want to say is the following. I want to say that one of the ways to say that you have the algebraic closure in ordinary algebra is to say that in the algebraic closure, and I want to say really separable closure, not algebraic closure. Well, in either case, you can say the word algebraic or separable, but I'll talk about the separable closure. The separable closure in ordinary algebra is an object that receives homomorphisms from any non-zero separable extension. So it's sort of weakly terminal object. It doesn't receive a canonical homomorphism, but it always receives homomorphisms. And that the connection of polynomial equations is that if you wrote down any, say, separable polynomial, then you'd get a corresponding separable extension. And then the solution is the equation is the map to the separable closure. So that's the definition I have in mind, is that my definition of separable polynomial equation is really separable extension of my base tower, and I want the thing that receives, I want a sort of weakly terminal object among separable extensions. I want it to receive morphisms from any separable extension.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
So can your algebraic framework describe fecton phases?
No, I should have emphasized this at the beginning that, well, at least not yet. So there's, you know, it's worth reminding, especially reminding all the mathematicians who came, like me, came to this field coming from a topological kind of mindset. Most of physics is not topological phases. Most of most of the real world is very non-topological. And there are rich even gapped phases like the fracton phases that I don't yet know how to fit into this world. I expect it's not too far. I actually do think that, well, my iPad fell asleep. I'm gonna stop sharing. I actually do think that in the next, say, 5 or 10 years, this type of higher algebraic, this sort of type of higher algebra will be really useful for describing non-topological objects like fractons. I've seen some very inspiring lectures about trying to use these also higher algebra also to say things about hydrodynamics. And I think that's kind of, that's not like, but it's not yet there. I think
what are the assumptions that fail for the fracton phase in your to fit in your framework?
Well, as I said, like, I don't have, you know, there's a question of tuning the definition of gap topological phase, but the fracton phase has a phenomenon that, there's a couple things that happen in it. So although on any, if you place the fracton phase on any spatial manifold, you get a gapped system, the ground state degeneracy depends sensitively on how you placed it on the closed manifold, and for instance, isn't a topological invariant of the closed manifold. And so I would rule it out already for that. But even more than that, even if I'm working locally, which Lee didn't like me to do, but he's gone already, so he can't object anymore. If I locally in a Fracton phase, the whole thing that's interesting in a Fracton phase is that there are gapped insertions that cannot be moved completely topologically. And when I say topological phase, what I have in mind is a very special type of gapped phase where the gapped insertions also have a topological, completely topological behavior, that they don't, that they're sort of locally constant as you move them around.
I see. So limited mobility of defects is
sort of a symptom of non-topological behavior.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, if not, let's thank you again for the lovely talk.
A pleasure.